I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Rich Eisen Show.
He cared about one thing and one thing only. Win time. Winning. Championships, trophies in the case. We'll figure out the money later on.
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay then.
You put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Earlier on the show, LSU football head coach Brian Kelly. Coming up, Lakers writer for The Athletic, Bill Oram. From the HBO series Winning Time, actor Solomon Hughes. And now, it's Rich Eisen.
Hour number three of the Rich Eisen Show is, in fact, on the air. 844-204-RICH, number to dial if you'd like to have a conversation. We've got a lot of Lakers stories going on around here in Los Angeles. We've got Lakers on the brain for hour number three. Solomon Hughes, the actor who plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the hit HBO show called Winning Time, based on Jeff Perlman's book on the Showtime Lakers. He will be here coming out in about 20 minutes time. Can't wait to chat with him. The difference between the past and present and reality and what's not real couldn't be more stark right now, as the Lakers missed the play-in tournament. And normally when you say that, of course, that means they're one of the top six seeds in the Western Conference. But it takes some doing to not be one of the 20 teams to have a chance to win the Larry O'Brien Trophy once the regular season is over. It takes a lot of doing. And normally you got to purposely tank to get in that spot. And I proffer to say the Lakers did not do that. They earned every last bit of their being on the couch. And here to talk about it from The Athletic, man who covers the team and has written so many terrific stories and columns and opinion pieces on them, Bill Oram from The Athletic here on The Rich Eisen Show. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm great, Rich. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so why? Why did this happen? Why?
I think hubris comes as kind of the first reason before we start unpacking injuries and, you know, kind of the malaise of the season. But there was a real arrogance that I think the Lakers had coming into this year, that you could tear down a roster and put 11 new guys around three superstars and that it would work because you're the Lakers, because you have the best top-end talent in the NBA, in LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and that will work. And even if you go back to the preseason, the Lakers were very casual about things. They went 0-6 in the preseason, which, you know, in and of itself is not an indicator of where things are going, but they also did not look good. Even when it was like Russ and AD were on the court in the preseason, that did not look good at all. The supporting pieces didn't look good. And when I remember talking to Carmelo Anthony early in the year, and he's like, listen, it might take us all year to figure it out, but it's okay. We're veterans. We can use the season to, you know, be playing our best by the end of the year. And that was sort of the mantra of this team the whole way through, except for you never saw them getting better. You never saw them moving toward becoming a better team by the end of the year. And obviously injuries played a huge part in that. The Lakers didn't win consecutive games, however, until the last two games of the season from January 7th. So that's 3 months that they couldn't put it in gear for more than one night at a time. So tons of reasons. I mean, everybody has a share of the blame. Frank Vogel already paid the price. But, there's a lot of reflection, I think, to be done within the Lakers, not just from, you know, how rosters are assembled, but to how decisions are made, who's calling shots, what they want their identity on the court to be, because that has changed every single year LeBron James has been here.
Well, I mean, you mentioned LeBron. Let's just hit him right off the bat here. When he says the season was not a failure, what do you think he means by that?
I think he means it in a very abstract way, which was everybody, competed. Everybody was, trying hard to make it work. But, he's just wrong. I mean, it's an abject failure from any measure, right? I mean, you play to win championships. You play, Rob Pelinka sits at a press conference and they bring in Russell Westbrook and says the Lakers are obsessed with winning championships, winning their 18th championship. So not even making it into the postseason to have a chance represents a failure. I think LeBron is basically saying the failure was out of their hands. When he misses 26 games, when AD misses nearly half of the season, other guys who were hurt and in and out of the lineup, you can't blame the team for not winning when they weren't on the court together. But you also had a team that was heavily dependent on players over 35 years old. You had super high expectations for a guy like Trevor Ariza. You brought in a third star, Russell Westbrook, who, even if you thought you knew something that everyone else didn't, the prevailing take around the league was that was not a good fit for Russ, that was not going to work, and that the Lakers made themselves worse by trading, two or three, depending on how you feel about Montrezl Harrell, really valuable role players plus a first-round pick for Russell Westbrook. That was not a surprise when that did not work early in the season. So, it wasn't just the injuries. This was a team that was not going to achieve the success by their own standard of success in almost any situation.
So Westbrook yesterday, too, Bill Oram, was talking about his relationship with Vogel. And is it just as simple Vogel didn't want him? Because he was talking about needing to prove himself to a coach that clearly knows Russell Westbrook's game and his resume and what he brings to the equation, and wound up, if I'm not mistaken, leading the team in minutes played and and games and things of that nature. So he did get out there, even though there were times where he was benched. What was the Vogel-Westbrook relationship that might have been the heart of everything that we're talking about right here?
Yeah, I mean, the best ability is availability, right? So Russell Westbrook played in, until they shut guys down at the end of the year, he'd only missed one game all season. So he was, the guy who was going out there every single night. And, as losses mounted up, whether LeBron, AD were in and out of the lineup, the guy who was out there kind of at the front of it every single night was Russell Westbrook. So I understand why he feels like, a lot of this got pinned on him. But, without knowing this directly, I would interpret that it is fair to say that Frank Vogel was not happy that Russell Westbrook was added to the mix. You had a really awkward basketball fit from the beginning. And so Frank Vogel was asking Russell Westbrook to adapt his game in ways that he had never had to before to fit on a team with LeBron, who's going to be the predominant ball handler, and Anthony Davis, who also needs the ball in his hands. And Russ was going to need to do a lot of things that he wasn't used to doing: screening, spotting up, getting out of the way, playing off ball, and that really was a really awkward, there were growing pains. And Russ, he said yesterday that he's never not done what a coach asked him to do. My coaching sources said that Russ was very reluctant to do a lot of the things he was asked to do, that he was not receptive to feedback, that he wouldn't look at the clips that, he was given to sort of help him along the way. So there was a real divide between what the coaching staff was wanting from Russ in an effort to make this, sort of fundamentally clunky fit work, and what Russ felt he could do to actually help. And, that's why I think the Russ problem was so dominant, because if you're Frank Vogel and you've only got 24 hours in the day to think about your team or think about making your team better, how many hours of those are being spent on Russell Westbrook? 15, 16? Mm-hmm. So and at some point you have to sleep. So when do you think about the other issues? When do you start thinking about rotations? When do you think about, Avery Bradley, Malik Monk, Austin Reeves? And this is not to say that, Frank Vogel didn't do as thorough of a job as he could. I believe he did. But I think that there was so much time spent trying to untangle the Russell Westbrook mess that took energy away from finding solutions to the other issues the Lakers encountered.
But Bill Oram of The Athletic here on the Rich Eisen Show, and as we turn the page to start focusing on what's next, I'll just read out the headline of your latest story or column, if you will, on The Athletic that I suggest everybody read. Lakers' shameful handling of Frank Vogel should be warning to potential replacements. I give you the floor on what that means, Bill.
So it goes deeper than the way Frank Vogel was fired, which I hated. Hated that it was first reported basically at the buzzer of the Lakers' final game of the year, which, by the way, was a pretty, you know, feel-good moment, all things considered. You know, the players hadn't even left the court yet, and there was a report that Frank Vogel was going to be fired and would be informed as early as Monday. I hated that, you know, Frank then had to go sit in a press conference room and answer questions about that. I hated that that he didn't hear it directly from his superiors first. I hated that it took away from the night that guys like Mac McClung, Austin Reeves, Malik Monk, Mason Jones, guys who got their moment in the sun because of this season, that they had that opportunity to kind of have a little bit of shine from their head coach taken away from them. So I just really hated that Frank Vogel was left kind of flapping in the wind for about 12 hours before he was finally fired. You know, had to fly home with that report hanging over his head and no clarity. I don't think that's the way business should be done. And whether it was directly the Lakers' intent to have that reported then or not, in my opinion, once the decision is made to fire the coach, you as the organization or as the general manager and Rob Pelinka are the custodian of that information. And so what happens with that information until it gets delivered directly to the coach who's going to be fired is your responsibility. And the Lakers, and to wit Rob Pelinka, failed and I think really embarrassed the organization with the way that went down on Sunday night. But to the broader point, Rich, the Lakers have really not valued coaching going back to the end of Luke Walton's tenure. And it's bigger than, you know, whether you think Luke Walton's a good coach and should have been fired or whether Frank Vogel's a good coach and should have been fired. You remember when the Lakers hired Frank Vogel, he was their third choice
yes.
at best. They tried to hire Tyronn Lue, who balked at the idea of a three-year contract, felt like that was beneath him. Monty Williams also was not picking up what they were putting down in terms of years and commitment. But Frank Vogel was a guy who was, you know, had been fired in Orlando. He was coming off of two losing seasons in Orlando, and he was willing to take a three-year contract. And I think we kind of think of that as a make-good deal. Like, you are, you know, you are kind of somebody who's willing to take a little bit of a lesser deal for what, you know, coaching the Lakers could potentially net you. And Frank Vogel made good on that. And he won a championship in his very first year, could have been coach of the year, I think, that season if awards were voted on, after the bubble. I think he probably would have been the coach of the year that season. And to me, it just he did not get a contract extension that off season. He coached the Lakers the next year, and then at that point, he's up for a contract extension. He's coached the best defense in the league the previous season, and the Lakers gave him a 1-year contract extension. A 1-year contract extension in the NBA might as well be your walking papers. It's not a vote of confidence. It's not a show of support. It doesn't tell your locker room that we believe in our coach. And to me, I think that dug the ground out from underneath Frank Vogel from before this season even started and sent the message that as soon as anything went awry, he was expendable. And that's why you started hearing, you know, murmurs about Frank Vogel losing his job as early as November. If the Lakers had believed in Frank Vogel more and given him more support, you know, a coach who is, you know, fundamental to the organization or central to the vision of the organization can survive down years or injury-laden seasons. And that's where the logic of all this sort of, doesn't track. If it's the injuries that derailed the season, then why are you firing the coach? If it's the roster construction that derailed the season, then why are you firing the coach? And the answer is because, you know, somebody needs to take it. And in this case, the guy who doesn't have a lot of years left on his contract, very intentionally, has to take it. And so, listen, the Lakers are a prestige job. They're going to have guys. They're going to be candidates who want it. But I do think the Lakers have to do some serious reflection about what they want, what kind of destination they want to be for coaches. If they want to keep getting, you know, coaches who are sort of outside of the top tier of candidates, coaches that they can push around a little bit, coaches who will acquiesce to being told who is going to be on their staff and having Rob Pelinka and Kurt Rambis in their coaches' meetings, they can go find, you know, those sorts of candidates, and then those candidates should be prepared to be treated poorly and fired in 2 or 3 years. But if they want to really take a step forward as an organization, they will step up the support they give their coaches, the autonomy they give their coaches, and the security they give their coaches. And that has just not been their philosophy in Rob Pelinka's tenure as a basketball executive.
Well, I mean, I think you're kind of hitting on that, Bill, as we wrap this up here, is like, who's going to be making the decision, right? I mean, there's Jeannie Buss, there's Rob Pelinka, there's, as you mentioned, or the people who are referred to around in this town as the Rambi, both mm-hmm. Rambuses, right? Then you have LeBron, who one would think, you know, your colleague Sam Amick there at The Athletic saying that LeBron would be, The Athletic tweeting out, LeBron James would be very enthused by the prospect of Mark Jackson landing the job. Is that his way of telling everybody this is who at King James would give the blue check mark to? And then how does that all work together? Right.
I would say that, you know, LeBron did not get his coach the last time around, by the way. Ty Lue was the preferred candidate of Camp James. And, you know, LeBron never threw the Lakers under the bus for bungling that coaching search, at least, you know, from LeBron's standpoint. So I'm very curious to see how much weight his word carries this time. So you would think a lot. But, you know, all those pieces you're talking about, the Lakers would describe it as you know, collaborative, right? That everybody has a voice, everybody's a stakeholder, and that makes it, you know, a great place to work. And I think other people, at least on the outside, and I know of some people on the inside who feel this as well, this way too, where it's too many cooks in the kitchen and there's a lack of structure, a lack of organization, and ultimately a lack of accountability. And that is where I think the Lakers have really gone strayed in the last, you know, to go all the way back to the passing of Dr. Jerry Buss, who left this to his children to kind of carry on.
So I guess last question is, what's the timing on this? And I'm assuming as well, whoever's coming in, that it's the same roster, right? I mean, like what?
Oh yeah, why would you break this team up, Rich?
No, but I'm serious. I'm the reason why I'm saying that is you already hear LeBron say, you know, just 21 games for me, AD, and Russ. And, you know, even though there were 11 and 10 in those 21, I assume he just assumes you give them twice, three times as many cracks at it, they'll be better than one game above 500. The season's not a failure. I think part of him is sitting there thinking the injuries really did him in. Like, he wasn't available. And so I'm assuming, right, like they can't move Russ, that this is the way it is. Whoever comes in, you're going to have to do a better job of figuring out this mix than Vogel did.
I mean, you can put a new paint job on a car that's broken down. The car isn't going to drive any better. I think LeBron is sort of polishing the narrative on the season he's putting behind him. You know, I don't think that if you had, you know, gave LeBron James truth serum and you said, do LeBron, AD, and Russ work together for next year, should that be the direction of this team? I do not believe he would say yes. I think that LeBron James will actively work behind the scenes to help Rob Pelinka find a way to relocate Russell Westbrook. I don't think Russ will be back. I don't think Russ wants to be back. And I don't think, despite what LeBron said yesterday, LeBron wants him back either. I think there is a very clear understanding that this was a partnership that did not work out and needs to be addressed. So I think you will see LeBron and Anthony Davis back next year. I think those are the pillars of this organization. I think that, you know, the Lakers would love to have a third star. I think that they learned that it's not going to be Russell Westbrook. So I think by whatever means necessary, I think it will not be Russell Westbrook.
What do you hypnotize Leon Rose? How do you get rid of Westbrook? What do you do?
I mean, I do think that Russell Westbrook is an expiring contract in the NBA in a league where that really matters. And not only is he an expiring contract, he's a huge expiring contract. So if you are a team like Indiana or Charlotte that has a couple of guys who are under contract for three years at 20 some million dollars a year, and you are not trying to win right now, it makes no sense for Charlotte to be paying Gordon Hayward. Even better, it makes no sense for Charlotte to be paying Terry Rozier 20 some million dollars through 2025. Like, that is not their timeline. That doesn't make any sense. But what you can do if you're Charlotte is you can package Rozier and Gordon Hayward for Russell Westbrook and maybe a draft pick because the Lakers are desperate, and you suddenly have that $47 million in cap space in the summer of 2023. And that looks like it fits your timeline a whole lot more. Mm. Same with Indiana. So I do think that that expiring deal is more valuable than we give it credit for, or when we talk about who would want Russ. I don't think anyone wants Russell Westbrook at this point. I think there are very few teams that look at him as the player that that transforms a team into where they want to go. But that contract becomes very, very appealing. But the problem is everyone in the league knows the situation the Lakers are in. And so I don't think, you know, so I think a team like Charlotte or Indiana could then, you know, force the Lakers to include a pick as well. And then, and just because of the desperate situation they're in. So the Lakers are going to be at a disadvantage in trying to come off the Russell Westbrook deal. But I do think it can be done.
Bill, thanks for the time, man. Let's do this again real soon. I have a feeling this is going to heat up. Thanks for the call. Thank you.
My pleasure,
and the knowledge.
Thank you.
Bill Oram, I'm smarter for that conversation. Hope you are too. We go from cap space for the Lakers to cap. Man who plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Winning Time. The actor Solomon Hughes live in studio when we come back. Let's talk O'Reilly Auto Parts, people, or as you might know from their jingle, O-O-O, O'Reilly Auto Parts. They're in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offers friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs, because you know when you need your car fixed, you need somebody who knows what they're talking about and is helpful, has a smile on their face, and gets you back on the road. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. The team at O'Reilly Auto Parts can test your battery for free in or out of your car. If it needs to be replaced, they'll help you just find the right battery for your vehicle. Need your windshield wipers replaced, a brake light fix, or a quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. Whether you're a car aficionado or an auto novice, you will find the employees at O'Reilly Auto Parts knowledgeable, helpful, and the best of all, friendly. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/Eisen. That's OReillyAuto.com/Eisen.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Solomon Hughes of HBO's Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, here on The Rich Eisen Show on HBO and HBO Max. Our terrestrial radio audience has returned. Solomon Hughes, who plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, is here. First time you saw yourself in the goggles and the uniform, did you have the same reaction that I did, which was
absolutely
like,
oh, I mean, God. The makeup and the hair department, just the work that they did. Everybody that had a part of this project just brought their A game. And so, you know, like, when I walked into the trailer and saw the wig, I was like, I had this moment of like reverence. And then, of course, you put the goggles on, but it was just, I mean, it's just from top to the bottom, it's just the details that people paid attention to was just, it really made it so much easier to get to step into the space of being this great character.
And I assume you were like the rest of us, and I didn't play basketball at Cal like you did. Yeah. Reverence for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar from birth, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's like the prototype, right, for when you're thinking of a dominant center. And so, you know, growing up in Southern California, the Lakers were my team, and he was literally the center of that that universe. And so, so it was the other thing is, as an actor and trying to embody the confidence of such an incredible basketball player was fun and very challenging, because when I played, I was like anxious and terrified. And so like stepping into like just his dominance was also something pretty special.
Well, first couple of episodes of Winning Time, and when we see you, you hardly say a word, right?
Yeah.
Like so you're acting without actually speaking.
Right.
You know, certainly the scene where Jerry West comes to find you meditating and reading, looking over the Los Angeles landscape to inform you as Kareem that Magic is, he's going to put him down in the post.
Right.
And he's going to take all the elbows instead of you.
Exactly.
And you hardly say a word to him.
Right. I mean, what is it? They say it's like, you know, 30% of communication is actually articulating something with words, like using your vocal cords.
Right.
And so, there's so much of just his presence, right? He's thoughtful, he's soft-spoken, But he communicates so much with just his presence and his body language.
And
so,
is it true that, is this your first acting job, Solomon?
This is my first professional acting job. It is, yeah.
How did they find you?
So Francisco Elson, who played basketball with me at UC Berkeley and played with the Spurs, won a championship with the Spurs, a casting agent had reached out to him in 2019. And Francisco's in the Netherlands, and he wasn't interested, but he suggested me. And so the casting agent reached out to me. And, you know, honestly, Rich, I tell people, right after I graduated from college, I moved down to LA, and I had two goals in mind. I was going to pursue a professional basketball career, but I was also interested in acting. And so I went as far as meeting with a talent agent, and it was like the most dismissive meeting I've ever had. I mean, it was like the guy so clearly articulated that I was wasting his time. And so, like, literally, the door shut on my face. And so I'm someone who has always had a fascination and an interest in this space. Because film and TV and theater have had such an impact on my life personally. And so so when the audition opportunity came my way, I was just excited to just put myself out there and just, you know, get an answer, a yes or no. You know, this is like after years of just like literally looking on Craigslist for opportunities in local shorts. Like this was, at the very least, I get an answer. And so, yeah, after two auditions, I found out I got the part and I was like, what? So, yeah.
How did you approach playing Kareem then when you were trying to get ready for such an important audition?
Man,
for
you know, like years? Literally, like just I liken it to how I prepped for writing a dissertation, right? Just like the ultimate research process, just like pouring myself into everything, watching all of his interviews. I mean, we're blessed that we're in the YouTube era, right? Where there's lots of footage that you can draw from. But I mean, I've been reading the stuff that he's been writing about himself since I was a kid. You know, Giant Steps is one of the first big books that I read growing up.
Is that right?
And so, yeah. And so, and you know, his documentary, Kareem, A Minority of One, which is, it's incredible. I feel like of the people that are part of this project, I definitely benefited from someone, from Kareem being pretty generous about how much he shared about his life.
Because, so. I heard that you had reached out and he was not terribly interested. I don't think many Lakers of that era are terribly interested.
Right. I mean, I've gotten the opportunity to meet Jim Jones, and he was awesome. He was in Cleveland with us. Mm-hmm. Obviously got to meet Norm Nixon. And
true, because Devon has been in that chair.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
playing
here.
His dad
This
is kind of crazy.
Right. Yeah, and so yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that with time, you know, people will see that this project, this story, it's coming, you know, it's coming from the hearts of like real deal fans who have so much admiration for it, just how they literally changed sports.
So. And I just love all the touches. We talk about it all the time. All the touches from the way it's shot and the way the communication between the you know, the characters goes down. And sometimes it's real and we wonder what's real and what's not. And just the little touches about the pop culture of the era. When I saw you dressed as the Kareem in the pilot in Airplane with the kid next to him, like they got down every like look at it on the screen right there. Like that's it. And that's you're dressed as
in the same cockpit. Same cockpit.
Come on.
That real. That's the same cockpit that they shot Airplane in. Yeah.
They got the same cockpit
same
for this?
Cockpit, right, yeah.
Wow. And that line where you tell your dad to drag Walton and Lanier up the court, you know.
Exactly. Well, and then afterwards, you're just like, bleep off, kid.
You know? Right. And that kid was so great. Landon Gordon, such an incredible actor. He's great. We had a lot of fun that day.
I mean, that looked just like it.
Awesome.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Just seeing John C. Reilly walking around his bus. I mean, do you just bust out laughing a little bit sometimes
it's,
or what?
I mean, from Adrian Brody to Jason Segel to Jason Clark, it's like, you know, I definitely had maybe a month of just like the fanboy stuff where every time I saw them, I was like, you know, do I say hi? Do I not say hi?
Right.
And then, you know, then you're colleagues and you're working together. But yeah, I mean, just the amount, to your point, the amount of detail that hair and makeup and set design put in, it's really fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, the forum too, just to see the forum like it's back in the day.
Exactly.
And just to see, you know, the outfits and the cars and the stuff of the era. Right. Solomon Hughes here, who plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on The Rich Eisen Show. And so you spent time as a Harlem Globetrotter as well? That happened?
Okay. I played 13 games. So, I guess I qualify because I went through the training camp. So, yeah.
That counts.
That
It counts.
Right. So it was.
By the way, I have not played one single game as Harlem Globetrotter. Just in case.
Generals? No.
That would be more Richie Sweat.
Not at all. I was in a general. I wasn't anything. I've been to Washington, but. And I've been to Harlem, and I've been around the globe. Right. But other than that, what was that like for you?
I don't think they do this anymore. But I guess it was 2002. They put together a team that would play exhibition games against college teams in the preseason. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think the NCAA like changed the rule around that like a few years ago, where now you just can play other colleges. Mm-hmm. And so the team it basically consisted of former college players who aspired to play pro ball. And former NBA players. And so, it was quick. It was 13 games. It was, the training camp was as brutal as anything I've ever done in my life. And a lot of the former NBA players who were playing with the Globetrotters were saying, this is as tough a training camp as we've ever seen. And I think part of it was they just wanted to see who could last on the road. Because the idea was you would go from that team to then playing on the team that would do the performances and the tricks. And so I made it 13 games, and then I was done. So
you were done. Done. And what happened then? I mean, is that when you got your like you went to get a degree? Is that where, or you already had your doctorate?
No. I feel like it was I think I'm the guy that was 6'10", had some talent, but was really playing basketball just to make some money. And so I feel like it was a good life lesson to learn pretty early that you never pursue something just for the money. You need to have some underlying passion, and so. I think that was like a crash course in, are you doing this for the right reason? And so leaving that, I think it just, I did have aspirations to play in the NBA and I got as far, I tried out for the Phoenix Suns summer camp. And so,
That was
2003. And so, didn't make it. They were polite. They, on the ride back to the airport, I was like, okay, I think I need to start thinking about other, ventures or whatever. And so mm-hmm. that's when I started thinking about grad school and going back into the realm of education.
Okay. So you're technically a doctor, right?
I do have a PhD.
You're Dr. Hughes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but you can call me Solomon. That's perfectly fine.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool.
Not like Dr. Buss, who preferred that everyone call him Dr. Buss.
I got to tell you, man, I moved out here to L.A., and I saw him at Dan Tana's one night.
Really?
With two highly age-inappropriate people. And, it was wild, cool, everything, because Susie was covering the Lakers at the time, and I look at her, and she's just like, yep, this is what goes on around here in Los Angeles. It's just wild to see this whole thing on television like that, what would you want the real Kareem to know if you could, Solomon Hughes, about what you've learned or what you want him to know about how you're playing?
I think the learning, right? It's like, I think when I was prepping for this, I'm like, I'm a Laker fan. I've been a Kareem fan since I was a kid. So I feel like I know a lot about him, but just the journey of his life. Right, just the paths he's taken, just the way he's let his intellectual curiosity goad him in different directions. It's just it's a tremendous life, and I know I'm one of millions of people that are just really grateful for it. I mean, honestly, like I think of me stepping into this professional acting space as me resisting the one dimension of just being the tall black basketball player, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like. I know I'm one of many people that just has a ton of gratitude for him and the work that he continues to do. I mean, the Skyhook Foundation, I just think it's a brilliant organization. I love what he's doing with that. So I feel like just all the ways he's showing up in these different seasons of his life. And so, and then ultimately, I hope he gives the show a chance because it's really a labor of love. You know, for everybody just every day just put into the pot their best effort, and we're, we're getting good feedback about the show because the beauty of a show is it's not just 60 minutes. You get time to tell about the multiple dimensions of people's lives. And so, I'm hoping with time people will give it a chance.
What's the one mannerism of his that you think you've picked up? Which one?
So I think, his pace of speaking when he's trying to talk to a young Magic Johnson, he's thoughtful, he's deliberate, So, or just a little bit of the movement of the hand. So I think I've gotten
By the way, did you hear your voice just changed? Just went down. Okay, so then let me ask this question: are you more proud, Solomon Hughes, of you picking up his mannerisms or nailing his skyhook in these scenes while you're attempting the skyhook? Because that's That's big. That's huge.
Great question.
If you're going to attempt a Kareem skyhook, you've literally got to look like that.
Right.
So what do you got?
I definitely have to say the skyhook, but I'm not going to say that I nailed it. I think only one person nails it, and that's the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I feel like
Good answer. Because you know, right? Yeah, but I mean, you do though. I mean, you're a guy who's played the sport, and you are somebody who I'm sure is a perfectionist when it comes to that. And you just told me you were grinding when you were playing, like you were really in that. Yeah. So you have to see when you're watching that back and they show a skyhook, you got to be like, okay, that was good.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. It's rewarding, especially when it goes in. So on the day, so when we shot that Clippers scene, there were some scenes where I was shooting it in height shoes, which the height shoes are essentially the platform shoes.
Yes.
And it was wild. I mean, but you know, I was like one of those things where you really had to focus in. So yeah.
Isn't that amazing? They have to put you in them in platform shoes.
He's like 3-4 inches taller than me.
You're 6'10", right? Because
he's 7'2", right?
7'3". Yeah.
We've had Boban here, and I think he's the tallest guy we've ever had in the studio. Yeah. But when Kareem was here, I was truly concerned that he would scratch his head walking through the studio here.
Right.
You know, and I thought I'll just say it. I hope I'm not embarrassing you. Like, before you go on the air, you sat down like, is Kareem sat in this chair?
Right. Oh, no, exactly. Right. I've watched that interview multiple times, for sure.
Oh, great. Yeah, we'll take that. It was pretty cool.
Solomon, how did you find the training camp? Because when Devon Nixon was here, he was telling us that it was pretty grueling to get ready.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the vet. I'm 43, right? So I'm out there with 20-year-olds, right? And they're, you know, I'm trying to keep up. And I think I did a pretty good job, but as much as I was excited about the stuff, my body afterwards was like, you need to slow down, old man.
Are you a method actor where you made Quincy Isaiah truly bring you orange juice every day?
No, or not at
6
all.
In the morning?
No,
okay.
No.
with the newspaper?
right.
Like,
no chance.
Walk through that?
Yeah. I feel like I really benefit from the genuine relationships that are developing off screen, because I feel like it then just creates an atmosphere where you know going into the moment, you trust each other and you love each other and you can just really lay into it. So
It's great. Honestly, we're enjoying it immensely. You guys
Are you like us? Are you watching on Sunday night?
And so
like,
my wife is making me watch. She's making me watch. Yeah, and I'm enjoying it.
What do you mean she's making you watch?
You know, I'm the timid guy that doesn't even like watching old basketball clips. So like watching a full-on performance. But the great thing about it is essentially, everybody was kind of in silos when we were filming, right? So it's so cool to see what other people were working on and see how they're editing it and putting it together. And then the music, which is just so great.
Oh, it's spectacular. Yeah. It is. And that, you know, picked up for season 2 already. Congratulations on that. Yeah. So I am mandated to ask, even though, you know, you strike me as a very positive glass half full guy, but I'm from New York, so there is a little bit of spite in me. Have we revisited a conversation with the talent agent that gave you no time?
I forgot his name.
Come on now.
I think he's a rep, Billy Blanks. I think I heard that.
The Tybo guy?
The Tybo guy, I think, yeah. Yeah.
He discovered Billy, or
I don't know.
Okay, yeah. But this guy who gave you no time and made you feel like garbage, that you had no future.
Right.
We need to revisit him.
Well, there's a part of it's like if I forget the name, then I don't say the name and then give him any credit. Right. It's like, you know, go on, be blessed. You go your direction, I'll go my direction.
I understand. Yeah. That's the high road. I take a different approach. Screw that guy is what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying.
No, I got that all the time, trying to break into business and trying to get on TV. And I traveled around parts of the country just knocking on doors, literally knocking on doors of news directors to say, hey, I'd like you to hire me when you have a job open. And I felt like garbage. One guy, I got doors slammed in my face. Right. I was cursed at by one person. Yeah. And I would love to find every last one. And how do you like me now? You know what I mean? Like, so that's what I would love for you, man.
Yeah, but, no, you know, to that point, Rich, I definitely can relate to that. A number of instances of people like, you don't belong in this space, right? And so one of the things that I'm most grateful for with this experience is just how welcoming like the seasoned actors were. I mean, you talk about like they created a culture of belonging, and I really think that helped us really perform well. You know, like to a man, Adrian Brody, Jason Segel, Jason Clark, John, Gabby, Hatley, et cetera. Like, everybody, and the producers, the directors, it was like, it really was, we're welcoming you in, and we fully think that you can contribute something. And so, yeah, it made, that's it made awesome. A huge difference.
Yeah, we've had Michael Chiklis on here a handful of times, too. The fact that he plays Red Auerbach, he's got to be so out of his mind that he gets to play because he's such a masshole, and I say that with love. You know,
he's great.
Show's great. Yeah. Congratulations, Solomon Hughes. Anytime you want to come back here, you know, let's do it again. Right. Congratulations to you and all your success. At Solomon Young Hughes on Instagram, right? Did I get that right? Okay, very good. Season two has already been, it now is out there in the ether. It's coming back, which is great. Every single Sunday, 9 Eastern time on HBO, available to stream on HBO Max. Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, The Man Who Plays, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Solomon Hughes. Thanks again for coming here.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up this show in a moment. Get you set for the rest of the week.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Back here on the Rich Eisen Show, we just had Solomon Hughes, who plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And for our terrestrial radio audience, during our commercial break for you, during our Peacock and Sirius XM segment, we just showed a soundbite of Jeannie Buss when she was here in the summer of 2018 telling a story about how she met Magic Johnson the first time as a 19-year-old when Magic went to her father's house and she answered the door. And he told her that he was going to be in L.A. for 3 years and then go home and play for his hometown Pistons. And she then told her dad that, and he goes, don't worry about it. The first minute he steps on the floor at the Forum, he's never going to want to leave, which sounds exactly like the Jerry Buss character we see that John C. Reilly plays in Winning Time, except Winning Time, when they had the moment that Magic first met Jeannie Buss, it wasn't in a house. It looked like it was in an apartment.
Condo, yeah.
And it also was a moment she answered the door and Magic comes walking in. Magic did not mention wanting to go home and play for the Pistons in the scene. As a matter of fact, in the scene, he thought Jeannie was just another one of Dr. Buss's age-inappropriate
associates,
friends. And, oh, you're his daughter. Yeah. Again, just see how the show kind of puts its own twist on things and it's based on reality, based on truth. It is very entertaining. And again,
it's very fun.
Again, you know, Susie,
my wife, who
wow, puts this sign out here when she hosts the show, knows Jerry West very well. As you know, he's on this program, right? He's been here many times when
been
she
here,
gets
called
up.
In. Yeah.
Anyone who knows Jerry West, not happy at all about Winning Time, not at all. And a lot of former Lakers feel that way. And you could see Solomon Hughes would love to. I think you could see the kid would love to.
Well, also,
I mean, he's only 9 years younger than me. He would love to.
He grew up right down the street.
Yeah, I know.
Carson and Torrance. Carson and Torrance, like, was a diehard Laker fan growing up. Obviously, being a big guy, Kareem was his idol.
Right.
It's like, you'd love nothing more than to have that connection and relationship with a guy you're portraying.
I imagine Quincy Isaiah would feel the same exact way.
Absolutely.
About Magic.
I think everyone.
By the way, he's spectacular as Magic Johnson. Amazing. And I have no idea how real it is or whatever, but he is terrific at it.
Big star.
He's going to be big
stars.
Yeah, they're killing this.
That's
man.
One of the things I like to do on Monday. There are a few articles who are written, you know, the recaps.
We both do
and
this.
And they kind of like break down what's real and what's not, what's twisted, what's a little embellished.
That's what Susie and I do after every episode of The Crown.
Yeah.
I'm serious, we do that.
Yeah, it's fun to go back and kind of just see what, you know, what got kind of liberties.
And
taken.
Then when we find out what's not real and what we enjoy to the show, we're like, oh, damn.
I think they got us. One of the wildest things from last episode was the whole Phil Knight interaction with Magic, where if that's true and I haven't really seen any confirmation. But if that's true, the story they told about Phil offering Magic a dollar per pair in 18, cents a share. $100,000
in options at 18 cents a share. And then like Winning Time kind of does the math that, like, you know, if he never sold, it'd be worth over $5 billion. Now, that can't be confirmed anywhere.
Yeah,
but
no one's confirmed
Magic
that,
has said that Nike
it was life-changing
did
money,
approach him, and he just, you know, went with Converse.
Converse, I think, offered them $100,000.
Yeah, I don't know if Magic is, hurting right now.
Right now.
Magic is turning one of the greatest businessmen that's ever gone from sports to business.
True, but $5 billion is still
$5 billion. It's not my money.
Phil Knight eventually got his man.
It's all
He certainly did, didn't he?
No doubt.
And maybe if he gets Magic, he doesn't get Mike, and then I'm not wearing these shoes every day, so
Fact.
Who knows?
Maybe Mike goes to Adidas, because that was a story back then, too.
So, you know, sometimes you read something and it's different than the way it sounds. I haven't heard it yet. I've read it. I read it during a commercial break during hour two. Right now, it strikes me as a candidate for soundbite of the year. Jacksonville Jaguars, as you know, have made a ton of moves so far since the playing season ended. And free agency and what they've done and how they've maneuvered around and... as you know, I say the biggest addition for them will be Doug Peterson, not just because of who Doug Peterson is and what he's done and how he can do it, but just the mere fact that everything, how who he is and how what he's done and how he does it is not Urban Meyer. That alone will just be maybe their hugest addition. Then you think about, oh, that's right. They drafted Travis Etienne in the same first round as Trevor Lawrence last year. Didn't have him at all. Right. Kid unfortunately hurt himself in training camp. Never played it down.
Frank.
Right.
Year,
yeah. So he was asked today. I guess he was made available today, and talking about asked if he was glad he didn't have to go through the drama of last season.
No, definitely. That's just the human element of it. Just seeing the results, you definitely like. Phew, if there was any year to miss, I missed a great one. So,
wow.
Timing's everything in life.
Any year to miss.
Now, when I saw that on Twitter,
yes,
man, I was really hoping he kind of said that like dead serious, kind of like, man, I'm glad I missed this one.
No, I think this is even better.
But this is better. This,
I mean,
it's
like if you're producing and you're trying to you might want a different reading from Travis Etienne, but I think that's the final one.
Give me one for you.
That's the final one.
Yeah.
missed a good one.
Missed a good one.
Yeah. Coach didn't fly home, was then stuck around, was in a bar, and then a video got out, and it was embarrassing, and then he didn't apologize until it was pointed out that he didn't apologize. Then he apologized, and then that was after he kicked his kicker in training camp and started telling his head coaches, assistant coaches, they have to defend their resume. That was just the first month of the season. So, yeah, Jacksonville, it's going to be already, it's a better 2022. It's a better 2022. And interestingly enough, this being the final segment of our show, for those who might not be familiar with the television world, this segment is called The Kicker.
Hey.
And I think we just kicked it. Yes, sir. And by the way, this is going to keep going on and on and on, because every single time Doug Peterson does something and it's successful, for the first year at least, not Urban Meyer. Three words. James Robinson can fumble and get back in the game. Just think about it. Trevor Lawrence doesn't have to ask the coach about it. They get ice cream on Saturdays. Yeah.
And if you want to talk to your coach on the flight home, you can.
Yeah.
We'll go over some game plan.
Right.
Is he up in first? Is he in the bathroom? No.
Guys,
coach, I got something.
Guys don't have to have the plays slowed down for them to understand it.
And also, your coach will know about the players on the opposite team. That's like a really good ones.
Yeah, we'll know who Aaron Donald is.
Like number 99. Yep. Just someone you might want to know.
That's good.
Yep.
Scouting's better. That's a kicker. Nick Saban's on tomorrow's show. That's a coach.